It's been a while since you put me on the shelf. I know you've been distracted by somebody else. It's been a while, but that's all right, you see. And I'll be right here waiting when you want to play again with me.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Cult of the Old. I'm Ian McAllister, and I'm joined as ever by my co-hosts, Matt Thrower and Nate Owens. How are we doing, gentlemen?
I'm good, apart from my cold head.
Hat? Small fluffy animal?
Yeah, but those at home, obviously.
This, a cold head is different from a head cold, right?
Yes. I was going to specify that I have a cold head, not a head cold. It's just a seasonal thing, having no hair, being a man of violently receding hairline.
Men of a certain age, talking about board games on the internet. I'm Nate Owens. Hi, guys.
and Nate Owens has got a full and excellent set of hairs on his head.
Oh, luxurious. Luxurious it is, yes.
L'Oreal have been in contact with a contract.
That's right.
This podcast brought to you by L'Oreal. Anyway, enough of this nonsense. What do we do on Call of the Old? Well, each episode, I and my fellow hosts are going to dive into the tabletop gaming past. We're going to turn back the release schedule at least 10 years to look at games that were setting tables ablaze in the dim and distant past of a whole decade ago. In our first season, we concentrated on games that were still readily available to play in shops and you could physically buy. This season, we're throwing that rule out so we can revisit a lot of different games. So what are we looking at this cast? In the current era of tabletop games, it is easy to miss the really good games amongst the thousands of releases that hit the shelves every year. As critics, we try to sift the wheat from the chaff and bring you the best. We complain about the sheer weight of releases and the difficulty in finding good games. But good games being lost in the shuffle is not a new phenomenon, as our next game knows only too well. Overlooked for a Spiel des Jahres award the year of release, this game has always had a controversial place in the hobby. Hugely influential, but with a setting that could be easily described as insensitive, this game has had a massive impact on the hobby, and recently had an attempted re-release to get rid of some of the more problematic elements. We'll discuss that and everything else about this game as we travel to Puerto Rico. So, who wants to give me a one-minute breakdown? It's that guy.
I'll do it. I'm up for it.
Okay. On your marks. Ooh, not 10 minutes. 1 minute. Yeah, 10 minutes. On your marks. Get set. Go.
In the game of Puerto Rico, the players are going to be going through the whole process of producing goods on the titular island, shipping them back to the old world, and thereby getting victory points. The main mechanic of the game is a role selection mechanic, where on your turn you pick one of the roles, but everyone gets to take the action. You just get a special super version of that action. And the game kind of goes in these little cycles of production and creating plantations and bringing people in to work them, and then sending those goods off and getting victory points back for them. You also can build buildings that will make that process smoother or more powerful as the game goes on. After a certain amount of time, the person with the most victory points is the winner.
So, thanks very much for that, Nate. Excellent breakdown there. Puerto Rico was released originally in 2002. It was designed by Andreas Seafarth. Publisher was Alea, but it's had many other publishers over the years, as it's had a few different language variations. The artist was Harold Liskett and Franz Vowinkel. Famously, it lost out to Villa Paletti for a Spiel des Jahres in the year of release in 2002. It's had a few versions and expansions over the years. 2004 expansion New Buildings and The Nobles in 2009. It got a mini expansion called Buccaneer in 2019. And then it had a re-release last year, 2022, called Puerto Rico 1897, and we're going to come back to that, I'm sure, as we discuss the game. So first up, gents, how did we first come across the game? For myself, I played it the first time for this cast, so I can't really speak to it much in the period of release. When did you first come across it?
I initially got into the hobby around 2006 or 2007, which is kind of the perfect time for Puerto Rico for me to have gotten into it, because it was a very established game. Its influence was already well known at that point, but it hadn't yet hit this point where, you know, people just weren't playing it much anymore. It was still fairly common. You could still find it around. I think it was one of the very first games I had some of the people who like introduced me to hobby games. I think they were kind of going through that cycle of, oh, we bought this new game, you want to come over and play it? And I'd be like, yeah. And then like 2 or 3 months later, I was that guy buying hobby games and having people over. So I think this is one of the first ones we played. Curiously, I played it wrong for about a year. What I did was I was not giving enough victory points for shipping the goods. I was only giving one victory point per shipment, so that made buildings very powerful and shipping not very powerful, as you can maybe imagine. But I know how to play it now. I've played the game. I know how to play it.
Honest.
I don't think I've ever actually played a physical copy of this game ever. I'd played it before Nate, but probably not a long time before Nate. So it would have been 2004-ish, I'm guessing 2005, when it was still, you know, number one in the rankings, very influential. And I was very keen to try it, you know, because it's such a well-known and influential, impactful title at that time. But as I say, I've never owned a copy. But what existed astonishingly back in the early 2000s was an Excel spreadsheet that would play Puerto Rico for you. It was called Puerto Rico Evolver, and it was populated with statistics from thousands and thousands of games, which it used to play against you, and was actually really good. It crushed me over and over and over again until beating it became an absolute obsession with me. And I played it God knows how many times, and eventually did eke out a few wins. But it does indicate that Puerto Rico is literally the originator of the concept of a spreadsheet game.
Yeah, it blew my mind when, because we have show notes for all these episodes, folks. We put everything together. And when Matt wrote this into the sheet, I was like, I'm sorry, what? And then it still exists. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Yeah. It's still there. It's still around. Yeah.
Not only does it still exist, there's now it's good enough still that somebody's taken a Java framework and wrapped around it, you know, like a fully featured app, but it's still the same essential logic underneath and spread of game engine, spread of stats used to power the game engine. It's really good. I mean, it's really good at beating you at Puerto Rico.
I mean, as I said, the first time I played Puerto Rico is literally for this cast. I mean, I've heard about it, obviously, in its place in history in terms of the hobby. But yeah, it's available on Board Game Arena to play readily, folks. So I think it's still relatively easy to buy in shops as well still. So it's still out there. But yeah, there's a decent version on Board Game Arena, and there's also a tutorial on there which will take you through how to play the game, because that's how I learned to play it before playing it with Nate and Matt. That's pretty good.
Worth mentioning, I feel. Well, you know, this is why I learned my trade against Puerto Rico Evolver, you see. So Excel proved to be useful for something after all. But I should add that I have played it, although I've never played a physical copy, I have played it against other people as well as wonderful co-host here. I've played it quite a few times against other friends and random weirdos on Board Game Arena.
Matt absolutely crushed us in both games. Totally
he didn't absolutely
us.
Crush us the first time. The second time he rolled us. But the first time I think I lost by five or 10 points the first time.
He absolutely crushed me.
Oh, well, yeah. The second game was a laugher though.
Yeah, absolutely. So when Puerto Rico first came about, what do you think were the sort of influences on that game coming out?
So I did some research about this, and I discovered something really quite interesting, which is that, not directly relevant, but I'm going to mention it anyway, which is that Andres Seyfarth is extraordinarily under-interviewed designer. There's somebody that's really quite impactful and well-known. You know, he not only designed Puerto Rico, once hailed one of the best games of all time, but he has won the Spiel des Jahres for another one of his games, Manhattan, and he has a number of other fairly well-known titles.
He won for Turn and Taxis as well.
Oh, okay, so he's run it twice. Yes,
yeah, I play Manhattan. That's also on Board Game Arena and really enjoyed it, yeah.
Manhattan's a fun game. Yeah.
And so given all this stuff, because, yeah, Turn and Taxis, of course, is another pretty well-known game, there really isn't a lot of stuff of him going on record, at least not in English, because obviously he's a German designer, but there's very little I could find that was relevant. But the thing that he the one time he did answer questions about Puerto Rico is that he was at emphasis to say essentially that it was a theme. All of his things are apparently inspired by theme. It's really weird how all these semi-abstract Eurogame designers always claim to be inspired by theme. I do find that fascinating. Reina Nitzia and Seif Arthur, yeah. They all claim to be inspired by theme. Anyway, so the quote was that he said that lots of development chains merged. One of them was the idea to do something in the new world and build up an economy. The way of dealing the phases, what became known in the game as roles, came from another prototype with a setting in Prohibition time in the States, which is once again based on the theme. But apparently it took him 15 years to develop. 15 years. Which I'm not surprised at in some respects, because actually it's really quite a novel game. And I want to emphasize mm-hmm. this through this whole discussion, because it's something I didn't really realize until I came to do this, that idea, that role selection mechanic, you probably could have said that it came either from Citadels or El Grande, possibly. But the way he does it in Puerto Rico is new. Is fresh, the way, you know, making other people's repeat a lower version of the same action, you know, a weaker version, or giving a bonus to the person that takes the action more specifically, it was very, very novel when it came out. And we should detract from that when we talk about influences on the game. You know, this is a game that influenced others. It was very creative and deserves its place in the sun.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to say, because there's a lot of, I think there's some aesthetic and some stuff in the ether at the time that would have influenced it. Like I would really interesting. I haven't read too much about it because it hasn't been a big deal in a long time, but this game was published by the publisher, Aaliyah, as Ian said earlier, and Aaliyah at the time, and I think still does, they had this series called the Big Box Set, and they were these, you know, A4 size boxes that you'd kind of, you know, bookshelf boxes, like the old 3M boxes that Acquire came in. And this, especially the first five or six of these, I think Puerto Rico was number 7 in 2002. These are a murderer's row of medium to heavy Euro games. Ra was in there, was number 1. Taj Mahal was one of them. Princes of Florence was one of them. And I think Princes of Florence, even though mechanically it's not very much like Puerto Rico, aesthetically it looks a lot like Puerto Rico, in that it has the little buildings you have to have on your own personal board. That's a thing that's really distinct about Puerto Rico. You have a player board that's your own. Really common now, but I think at the time it was sort of a thing that would look like Princes of Florence. A lot of the themes of colonial and the Renaissance and things like that, these have been out there for a long time. And so, you know, in that sense, it had those influences. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Matt, that mechanically the game was kind of a big bang of a lot of other games. And I think it almost certainly was not the first game to do this, but the idea of threaded turns, this is something that Eurogames is kind of perfected. But the idea of, like, normally in a game, traditionally you'd be like, okay, it's my turn, then it's Ian's turn, then it's Matt's turn, and then it keeps going. But the way a threaded turn works is, okay, we go to this part, everybody gets to do something. We go to this part, everybody gets to do something, and so on and so forth. There's almost zero downtime. Yeah. In Puerto Rico, you are always having to make a decision, often kind of a tricky one. And it's you will not have to wait long to do something in this game. And I don't think Puerto Rico innovated that, but it's kind of a codifier for it. Like, it's when I think of what games do that, the big ones that come to mind are this one and Power Grid. But Power Grid does it in kind of a laborious, clunky way, because it's kind of that sort of game, as much as I love it. But Puerto Rico, it's butter smooth. Like, it just, and I think that's something that when you see that turn structure for the first time, it's sort of an aha moment. It's like, wow, that's really slick. Just the flow of the game is really impressive. And it's hard to find people who are, you have hard to find ancestors for a game like that. It really does feel, even today, feels pretty fresh for as old as it is.
Yeah, I really like that mechanic.
I think it's worth mentioning before we move on, just since you mentioned Princes of Florence, that I noticed a new edition of Princes of Florence has just come out, in actual fact, a reprint of it. And astonishingly, the box cover is even more boring.
Oh, wow.
I didn't think that was possible. That's a really boring box cover.
All of those Aaliyah big box games just had the most drab, tedious looking box. And there's some killer games in there. I really like Ra and I really like Taj Mahal. And I like Puerto Rico pretty well too. That's like, they all look boring. And I can't, you would have to really be trying to make it look more boring than that. Maybe that was the goal. Maybe people long for the days of boring European boxes.
The world's too exciting right now. Make our boxes really boring. Really, really boring.
The box equivalent of a glass of warm milk.
I mean, talking about new additions, it's probably worth mentioning briefly that there is a new version of El Grande just being announced at the Spiel Essen Fair. It's just gone because we're recording just at the start of November 2023. So that's going to be probably out start of next year, I think, new version of El Grande. Yeah.
It looks very nice. The box image, if you guys want to see it. You can feast your eyes on the mediocrity that is Princess of Florence 2.
I mean, if I didn't know better, I'd say it was made by bad AI. Ugh, that is terrible. Oh, that is bad.
Fun as well really makes it. Anyway, we shouldn't dwell on this. But if you want to play along at home, get an image up on your phone or whatever it is that you want.
If you too want to go as well, yeah. When Puerto Rico came out, what was the impact of that game at the time, folks? What do you think it did to the industry when it hit shelves?
I don't think either one of us played it in the moment when it came out.
Certainly didn't.
Yeah. But I will say, I have always associated... The thing I knew about... The first thing I knew about this game was that it was the number one game on Board Game Geek. And I think... I cannot prove this, but I really think that... It's sort of the game that made us care about the ratings game on that site.
Okay.
Because before that, you said it was Tigris and Euphrates before that. That's what we have in the notes.
That is correct, yeah.
And that's... I don't know how often that had changed before then, but Puerto Rico had the crown from 2003.
I think it had changed once. The initial number one. You see, and this is very relevant to your discussion because the fact that I can even tell you this... indicates how stupidly obsessed we are with this metric. Yeah. The first game that to get number one was Paths of Glory, astonishingly enough, card-driven war game. And then I believe it was Tigris and Euphrates, and the third, I think, was Puerto Rico to hold
it. And Puerto Rico held that crown for a good 4 or 5 years. It was a long time. And I think that Board Game Geek came out in 2000, and I feel like this is kind of a big step forward in how we view that website. And we don't, you know, I think we've kind of all expressed our ambivalence about Board Game Geek on this site, but it's impossible to discuss this hobby and not have it be a part of it. True. And I think that apart from everything else, apart from just the impact and people loving it, I feel like it was sort of a game that people kind of took on. This is one of ours. Like it didn't predate this site. It's like a game that came of age with Board Game Geek in a certain way. But this is before my time, though, so maybe I'm kind of misreading that. I don't know, Matt, you were a little closer to that time, but that's still before yours too. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
I haven't got really anything particularly to add to that or expand on that, but yeah, I think it's probably very likely. Yeah, it may have been whatever game was at number one would have made us care about it in that time era, I suppose. I don't know whether it was Puerto Rico or not. I guess we'll never know looking back on it. The thing that for me that Puerto Rico is the original spreadsheet game. It was so popular and so fated at the time that it really kickstarted that drive towards more. And Puerto Rico, jumping ahead of myself here, it is not an uninteractive game at all. It is not a multiplayer solitaire game in the slightest. But mechanically, it planted the seeds that took us down that road. Because before then, you know, like take Tigris and Euphrates, for example, take Ra, take the other big box games. A lot of those are actually fairly spicy.
Mm. Especially Tigris is very, very, yeah.
Exactly. And Puerto Rico is a little bit of a step back from that. And I think... It's novelty we've discussed, but these were the beginnings alongside the first worker placement games like Keydom, I think, is often seen as the first worker placement game, began to plant the seeds for this move towards multiplayer solitaire. And the curious thing is that I find it very difficult not to think of Puerto Rico as a worker placement game, even though it isn't. It is a role selection game, really. You just happen to put workers on buildings from time to time. True. They don't take actions there. And I think that's because, although it is not a worker placement game, it feels like one. It has that those feels that I have come to associate with putting a thing in a box, collecting a bonus, and ignoring all my other fellow players. So I think that's the impact it had at the time, is that it really made that style of game rise to the fore very quickly and stay there.
I think that's a good moment to sort of move on to our sort of critical impressions of the game. So we've touched on some of them there. I mean, I've been a little bit quieter on this one because I don't really know Puerto Rico as well as Matt and Nate do. But I've played it a couple of times with Matt and Nate. It's undeniable that it's a tight design. There's a real interesting depth of decisions, if not a wide variety of them. We talked about the BGG rankings there, and it still sits at 42 in the top 50. So it's, you know, it's still there. It's still very well regarded.
Which is remarkable for a game that's over 20 years old.
Yeah, like those, absolutely. Like,
the top 100 is such a recency bias thing that the fact that Puerto Rico survived that high up is really amazing.
I mean, the oldest, it's not quite the oldest game in the top 50. That lies with Crokinole, which is made in who knows when. Like, I think there's a guess date on BGG was when Crokinole was originally made. Crokinole, if you're not familiar with it, is a weird sort of dexterity game with a big circular board flicking discs into the middle. It's a very cool thing to see. The Crokinole boards are very, very nice. But yeah, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. Yeah, when I was playing, I really appreciated how impactful every decision was. Like, every time you did something, it felt like it mattered. It reminded me strongly of a game I played quite a bit of called Eminent Domain, which has got that role follow thing in it as well, which obviously I think basically comes from Puerto Rico, as far as I can tell. That's sort of like you do a thing and do it a bit more powerfully, and everyone else gets to do a version of that thing around the table, which I really, really liked. And I played Eminent Domain quite a bit. It's got a terrible name. Sci-fi sort of like card game. I don't know why it's called Eminent Domain. Terrible, terrible name. But it was quite a good game. I mean, even with the limited plays I've had of it, I could see the value that folks saw, and I could really see you getting into it and actually like sort of digging into it. There's lots of opportunities for blocking and predicting moves. I really enjoyed when I did. I mean, I've lost both games quite badly, but I did enjoy when I guessed correctly what you guys were going to do next. There's quite a thing in there, I think, of like guessing what your opponent's about to do so you can take advantage of the correct role for you at that time. If you don't want to do like the big version of it, if you want to just do the small version, you can sort of like predict a little bit of what people are doing. It's a very, very tight sort of Euro design, and I think it's in opposition to quite a lot of the modern Euro design, where designers seem to just pile on mechanisms after mechanisms after mechanisms to try and create complexity and depth out of that, like sort of mishmash of mechanisms. Instead, you've got depth in a very, very small number of like different decisions, which is really, really cool. And I really enjoyed.
So I really like Puerto Rico, and I got a lot of stick for this actually once upon a time, because older listeners may know that I was once very active in opposition to the dominance of Euro games in the hobby, a very active voice in that go. But the fact that I stuck up for Puerto Rico gave me a lot of stick. But I think it's really good. Mechanically, it's a great game. And there are two things that I really like about it. The first of them is what Ian just referred to just then, which is this limited decision space. I really do not like games that have enormously wide decision spaces, that they get their complexity and depth from going, here's 101 different things, choose one of them. And it's like, what? I have no go. A go really kills me in that regard, really absolutely murders me in that regard. But Puerto Rico, you often have a very small choice. If you're going last, it can be as little as like three things you can choose from. But those choices are enormously impactful. And weirdly, it's very clever how it manages to make a small choice, that limited design, to actually have you can think ahead about the choices that you're going to make. You know, these are multi-turn plans you can make, and yet you only have these very small choice windows to make, and they have huge impacts on the game state. And I think that's fantastic. I find it really interesting and engaging to think about decisions and the unfolding complexity of the game in that way. The other thing is its superb version of interactivity, where you are essentially, rather than attacking someone in Irkutsk or whatever it is, you are watching for opportunities to absolutely stitch other people up when they have left themselves vulnerable to that choice. So I'm talking about things like taking the trading house when other players have got nothing to trade, or there's only one space left in the trading house. The particular little joy of shipping stuff when you know that you've got what you're shipping already stitched up on the boats, and everybody else is going to have to throw their stuff away. That's just
I did
joyous.
That a couple of times. Yeah,
that's
fun.
You get to go. No, you're not going to send your corn to the old world for profit. You're going to dump it all in the sea while I enjoy my bounty of victory points. It's just such a satisfying thing. I think in terms of modern standards, the buildings. This is controversial to me. It seems there are clearly buildings that are better than others. That they're not always situation dependent, which is what you'd want them to be. There are sort of like the one of the reasons I did well, I think, is because I got the wharf and the can't remember what the other one is. Oh God, I've dried totally now.
The harbor. The wharf and the harbor are two different things.
That's right. They are. No, that's right. Yes.
And which I was very confusing initially.
Yeah.
But I got them both in both games, and that's a very powerful combination if you can do that. That's just an example. But some are definitely better than others, and I think that would people who were assessing it, if it were a new game now, would not let that pass as kind of like a fairly significant critical flaw with it, and I think sometimes that high rating that it enjoys on BGG is partly because of nostalgia. Not that it's a bad game, I like this game, as I've already said, but it's to still be at number 42, I think there's a degree of wishful remembrance there.
What about yourself, Nate?
I like Puerto Rico. I'm not sure to what extent I like it. I think there's a couple of things about it that are both like really good and really bad. It's an absolute Swiss watch of a design, by which I mean it's just really, all the mechanics are really tightly integrated with each other. And when you watch one cog turn, you see it rotating something else, and you just kind of watch it all. It's kind of a pleasure to watch it in action. I say this as someone, I played a ton of games now. I've reviewed all these games, and I still find Puerto Rico really impressive in just how it unspools and how cleanly it flows. Because, and this is something I think kind of is an underrated aspect of even these kind of abstract Euro design stuff like Princes of Florence and Puerto Rico and Kalis and all these are kind of games that, even if they maybe are long or they're complex or something, German games are always really good at flowing, keeping the game moving. And I feel like that's something that Puerto Rico it's a pleasure to watch it unspool. I do feel like the game is a little bit like chess. And by that, I mean, chess is only fun if the two players are about as good as each other. I think Puerto Rico has a little bit of that, not too much, but there's just not a lot of luck to cushion bad play. And you don't need that. Not every game needs to have that. I am fine having games that have a lot of that have those sharp edges and will punish poor play. That's a good thing. Not every game needs to be a dice fest. But this one is, if you're the new guy at the table, as Ian found out, you're going to get rolled. And you're not, like, there's just no other way around it. And that's, a lot of games are like that, but I find it kind of pronounced in this one. I think the thing I like the least about Puerto Rico, and this is a weird thing to say, to phrase the criticism that, like, this is something that just kind of drives me crazy. I sometimes feel like I'm playing to minimize how much I'll help the other players, and rather than how much I... rather than thinking about what I want to do and what's the best for what I'm doing now. And that's, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of games that we've talked about, Citadels. Last year, Citadels has a lot of moments like that. You don't take what's best for you. You take what someone else won't be expecting you to take. And some of that same calculus happens here. Maybe not trying to fool people, but just trying to predict what people are going to do. there's a pretty common thing that people have complained about over the last couple decades with Puerto Rico, which is what they call the binding issue, left and right binding. The player order can really determine if the expert is in turn order immediately after the new player. That expert's going to just destroy everybody, because it's really easy to set up someone else in Puerto Rico without really meaning to all the time. That's an observation more than a criticism, but it does make the game feel a little, I guess the word would be stuffy to me, just a little bit staid for my taste. I think I like something with a little more drama, and that's a little more forgiving than this. Not all the time, but in the abstract, I really, really appreciate the game, and I find it, I've actually, some of its descendants I've ended up liking more. We're going to talk about San Juan and some of the games that came after, but I still do really appreciate this, and it's one I like getting. I like getting to play it every so often still.
It's a game where you can't have the rough without the smooth, because that left right binding thing you're talking about is part and parcel of the thing I like about setting people up to fail. Yeah, which I find enormously satisfying and fun. But at the same time, you know, it is a problem with the design. It makes it a closed design. It makes it one that's very unfriendly to new players. So you know, you can't take the good stuff without the bad stuff in this game.
You're absolutely right. And I also think that certainly the original production by Alia, and that was released in the US by Rio Grande Games, at least at first it was, it did make, the game was pretty mechanically transparent just from the components. They did a good job, and this is an issue we'll talk about with the new edition. They did a good job at broadcasting information on the board. And if you've played before, you're like, oh yeah, I'm not going to sit here wondering what did that one do again? I don't remember what the mayor does. I don't remember how the trading house works and all this kind of thing. You don't have to do that. The game does. It's very transparent about those mechanics on the board, which is great. And that really helped. I'm sure that helped it at the time. It's not a looker on the table, but I know that part at least helped.
No, I was going to say, though, one thing that I do disagree with you about is that because it has that anticipatory thing where you're waiting to see what you're going to be left with, you're waiting to see what the player before you does and whether there's any traps you can set up and that kind of thing, that passes for drama for me in this game. Right? So I like dramatic games. I like exciting games. Yeah. I like a bit of luck in games. And you're right to say it doesn't have it, but I don't feel it lacks tension.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking of like the bomb kind of move, you know, the thing that just ends up like something changes and shifts really big. You know, it replaced Tigris and Euphrates. Tigris and Euphrates is a game that's full of bombs. Oh, that's like what that game is. It's like I play one tile and now the whole game is destabilized. And this is not that kind of game. No. It's much more stately and much more managed than that. Still really compelling, especially if you like just watching it move, but it's not a swingy game at all.
I think it's time to address the rather large elephant in the room, though. Observant listeners will notice we have not really touched on the setting of Puerto Rico very much, and it's quite a controversial one. For me, the setting and the sort of reinforcement of that setting in the game, to coin a Scottish phrase, it gives me the book. It makes me feel like sick. You have brown discs that you place in plantations. They are colonists, in air quotes, that arrive on ships. All the card art and box art features white people. There's not a person of color in sight. And yeah, it's a game set in a period of intense colonization in that area of the world, when the island was occupied by the Spanish, I believe. Now, there was an attempt to redress this with a new version that was refocused the game on the indigenous people of the area, called Puerto Rico 1897. That came out a year or two ago. The launch, as Nate has alluded to, was a bit of a disaster. Buildings came without text on them and referred to in the rulebook, and the rulebook was incorrect as to what those buildings did, or was just incomplete. There were missing tiles that Alia did send out to people, but they were missing in the box in loads of, like, not just one or two, like basically the entire print run was wrong. And an update from June of that year said that Alia were pulling the game and that a fixed edition would be out in autumn of this year. but I haven't heard anything about that yet. So I don't know whether they fixed that. I don't know whether the current version you can get is now correct or not. Now I am not a historian, but I did a little bit of research into like the area around about that time, because this edition claimed, and I'll quote from the BGG page on it, Puerto Rico 1897 takes place the year after Puerto Rico achieved political autonomy and separated itself from the colonial Spanish government. In the game, you take on the role of an independent Puerto Rican farmer in this new era and compete against others to hire workers to grow, sell, and trade valuable crops. Now, I didn't really think anything about it at the time, but when it came to doing the cast, I thought I'd look into, like, try to understand a little bit about the area at the time. And a cursory sort of like Google, looking up stuff on Wikipedia and then trying to confirm those facts through a sort of a bit of a search on online, I think that might be kind of rubbish. The history of the area, and again, I am not a historian, this is just bits and pieces I've read in researching this cast. History of the area is that, like, there was some that came close to autonomy in 1897. There was still a Spanish governor who could dingy legislation, basically anything they didn't like could just stop. And then the following year, in 1898, they were invaded by the United States of America. So there's maybe like a 4 or 5 month period where they have some sort of autonomy, but it feels like you're really papering over the cracks of that region trying to say this version of Puerto Rico is acceptable, it's okay, we've done away with the colonialism. It's like, you haven't really at all. It's always been a controversial game for this aspect of it. I don't know what you chaps think about it. Well,
it's gotten more controversial too. I think the first decade this game existed, the people who were really pointing out these issues were, I think it's fair to say, in the minority, not necessarily quiet or, but now this has kind of become the narrative around this game. And I don't think that's unfair. I've lived a lot of my life in various former colonies of various Western powers. And it's, colonialism and slavery was awful. Like, it really sucked. And I know that might sound flippant for me to say that, but I don't think, like, that's controversial for some people, but not the kind of people who I think I'm too worried about pissing off. So yeah.
if you disagree with these opinions, then feel free to stop listening to this cast.
Yeah, like, we won't, you won't undeniable. Hurt our feelings. I think it's important to, you know what, this is, it's such a blind spot. It felt like, for me, for a long time, I didn't think about it. It's like, no, it's just a game, right? It's cool. It's just a game. And I, you know, we all learn about our blind spots as we go. I don't know about Andreas Seyferth, if he's also, you know, he seems like a perfectly decent guy, what little we know about him. I doubt he would want to make something that would be controversial intentionally. It almost certainly seems like he just wasn't thinking about it. And hey, or just didn't think it was that big a deal. And I would want to ding him for that, except, hey, a lot of us have felt the same way at different times. That doesn't discount the people who've really enjoyed the game. That doesn't discount its impact and how important it's been to the hobby. But I think it's intellectually dishonest to not point out the enormous oversight in the game that either is due to ignorance or just papering it over. And neither one of those is a good look.
Yeah.
My suspicion is that it's ignorance. I am ashamed to say that I was very ignorant about it, and reading about Puerto Rico and some of the criticisms of Puerto Rico was a bit of a wake-up call for me. Not that I have ever been particularly pro-colonial or ignorant, I would say, about the horrors of colonialism, but I think Puerto Rico is a really good example, or the furor around Puerto Rico is a really good example of how this stuff slips under the radar and slips through the cracks. Because if somebody had said, made a game about the Black Hole of Calcutta, or somebody had made a game about literally the economics of shipping slaves across the Atlantic, then I would have been, you know, profoundly appalled and horrified by that, even back in 2004 when this first came out.
But 2002 I never was the even thought.
Yeah, sorry, when I first played it is what I meant to say.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, when I first played it. But it didn't occur to me at all, and this is to my shame, that this was a colonial game at all. Never even noticed. Then there was this famous thread, quite a well-known thread, where the game, somebody was playing the game with somebody who lived in Puerto Rico, and they looked at the little brown discs and it was like, yeah, these are slaves. These are the slaves coming ashore to work in the plantations. And my immediate reaction to that wasn't to dismiss it, but it was to say, well, surely that can't be true. Nobody would make a game so obviously grotesquely offensive as to include slaves. You know, that can't be right. And it didn't take me a long time to realize that it was right, of course, and how disgusting that was. But the fact that that was my initial reaction, I think, tells you a lot about the mindset of white Western gamers at the time. We didn't have to think about that stuff. We didn't have to take notice of it. That's our privilege. And it's by other people explaining to you and pointing out just how offensive these things are when you finally spot them, that you learn to do better. Which is the steps on the road to how we all improve, how we all go about making these situations. So I'm certain it was ignorance. Nobody sat and go, yeah, we're going to make a game about slavery just to emphasize the role of sort of like, you know, white masters in the economic development of the world. But people back then never had to think about this stuff. Designers, artists, at least the white designers and artists from Europe, of course, the people who were on the receiving end of it thought about it all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
and we're not talking about all that time ago either, like 2002.
But it really indicates how far we've come. And in some cases, you could say, you know, we talked about the impact of Puerto Rico. Well, maybe it's the fact that there was a game that put colonialism front and center, right at the top of the board gaming hobby, that started to open up this Pandora's box of conversations that we needed to have. Mm-hmm. About how we can better represent colonialism in light of the suffering that it caused over hundreds of years.
Yeah. I've been reading a book called The Privilege of Play by Aaron Trammell, and it's about it calls itself History of Hobby Games, Race, and Geek Culture, and it's basically about the sort of rise of geek culture out of early MIT and early sort of computer games and into sort of like early RPGs and board games and war games and sort of the white privilege from there. And he starts that book with, I think, maybe a reference to that thread you're talking about potentially, where someone just goes, oh, just make the discs green. Like, that will solve all the problems that are inherent in the setting of Puerto Rico. Just make the discs green. That'll solve everything. Yeah. It's definitely something we talk about, and like you say, Matt, it's a good point that like it started that conversation a lot of like, we need to address those things. If people come out with these kind of games and aren't aware or just from privilege, just don't think about these things, then it is something we absolutely need to talk about. It looking like the little bit of research I did and the problem I have with the new edition, it slightly disturbs me actually, because a lot of the people that were advocating for that edition of Puerto Rico saying, oh, this is a great thing, are people who were like very much like about sort of integration and sort of like making the hobby open to a lot of people. But it just feels like not a lot of research has been done there. It's just like just a very cursory sort of like this brief moment of history. If you looked at it just that, it might be okay. But it just, I don't know, it just feels like papering over the issue completely. And I've been trying to sort of formulate this argument in my head all day. It's like, if you took the mechanisms of Puerto Rico and put it in like space or a fantasy setting or something and just pushed that game out, is that ignoring the problem with the original game completely? Does that detract from the conversation we're having right now? If we do that? I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. That's a whole different cast on its own, I think.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer for you, but one thing.
Me neither. Yeah, I've been trying to sort of do it in my head all day, trying to figure out what the correct argument is there.
One thing I would say is that the point you make there about, and the point I made as well about people not being aware of it to start with, is exactly the problem, and the problem in the sense that the people we need to be asking that question of isn't us. It's the people who are actually impacted by it. They're the people who need to answer that question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it better? Would it be ignoring an injustice done if we just reprinted this game in a wholly abstract or sci-fi or fantasy theme or whatever? You know, does that make it better or does it make it worse? Not for me to say. It's not for us to answer.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And it's important to note that this is Puerto Rico is just one little facet of the very weird relationship that European games have had with the rest of the world, especially the developing world.
Yeah.
If it's not something like this, that's, I mean, we talked about Brass last year, and Brass is a great game, but Brass has this weird kind of like, these aren't cotton mills. They don't grow cotton in England. Where did the cotton come from? The cotton came from Egypt. It came from India. I mean, in India, there was starvation because they were changing farmland into cotton plantations. And I don't say this as a slight against the designers or the fans of these games, because, hey, you know, it's, we all have problematic faves. That's okay. You know, I mean, it's okay to admit it, but it's also, it, we have to be honest with ourselves and say, like, yeah, it's, there's an issue here. There's a problem here. A big one I always think of is the idea of what's called Orientalism, which is basically sort of this magic kind of viewing Eastern cultures as being kind of inherently magical or mysterious. Yeah. Or
I know what you mean.
This is a big issue in Five Tribes. I like Five. There's a couple of controversial things about Five Tribes. Mm. Speaking about slavery, I do like that game, but that's rampant Orientalism. The whole 1001 Arabian Nights. That's what that is. Or the very idea, and I don't, hey, we're going to, if we're going to really get some people angry at us, we can even start talking about the way European games have utilized, have appropriated other stuff. One of my favorite out-of-print games is a game called Manila. Manila is a really great game. It's a boat racing game, and you gamble on it. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Manila. It is just a name they put on the game, and they put some people with big Asian hats on, and we're just going to call it Manila. And I've played it with people in Manila. They had a ball with it, but they also were looking at it and saying, what does this have to do with anything? not offensive, but just like, this is just, it's just stuff. Like, it's just a name that they slapped on something. This is Puerto Rico is just one little aspect of this whole long history. And I'm so thankful that we have more than just white Western men in this hobby now who are able to point these things out. That doesn't mean I'm not, you know, don't misread me. I'm not saying we need to like chuck all this stuff into the bin and get rid of it all. We are all reckoning with the last, 100 years of pop culture and what stuff does and doesn't work for us. And it's okay to do that. And it's okay to continue to analyze it in those ways. But we have to continue to think about it and continue to wrestle with it.
Yeah, do get in touch with us if you've got any thoughts on this, folks. We'd love to hear what you think about it. And we're going to take a moment breather here and then move on a little bit. So, Puerto Rico, it's been a game around for a while. It's still in the 42nd position on Board Game Geek. What influences do you think it still has on the current era of hobby board games? Is it still a relevant game?
I absolutely think it's still relevant. I think that there's the way that this mechanic of role selection was utilized, it completely changed some pretty big games. A really big one is Twilight Imperium. The third edition took on these role selections, and it uses almost the exact same mechanic. And I've not played the fourth edition, but I'm guessing it carries over.
I played fourth edition very recently. It does. Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. That transformed how that game worked, because that game was, I've only played the third edition, but to my knowledge, it was just a big, massive 4X game in kind of the old school sense. To have this role selection, that totally revolutionized that game, and that kind of revolutionized the way we viewed Ameritrash games and big plastic games. That was one of the games that did that. And I think Matt's going to talk about San Juan, which is a card game version, but I think San Juan actually has an argument to be as impactful as Puerto Rico, because it's kind of the first modern tableau game as we look at them. It was a direct inspiration for Race for the Galaxy. And I love San Juan and Race for the Galaxy are both great games. I like those better than Puerto Rico. Glory to Rome, same kind of thing, took the role selection. So we see a lot of this stuff, especially in the 10 years following the game, there was a lot of stuff that really was impacted by this.
I can't believe I've forgotten about Twilight Imperium. That's an obvious, yeah, an obvious insult there. I played fourth edition quite recently, a little bit of holiday away with friends, and we took one of the days we took to play Twilight Imperium fourth edition, and that thing is a hog, but it was quite an experience. I mentioned Eminent Domain earlier. That's got a role selection and follow mechanic in it as well. So I've played that a little bit. I think like the major thing I noticed about Puerto Rico, and we've talked about it already, is that tight design. And I do think those lessons have been forgotten. As games have become, I mean, I've written about this on my own site, like games have become more complex, but complexity and depth are not the same thing. Just because you have lots and lots of mechanics that are kind of overwhelming and like people have to pick them apart, like they're like picking apart a pile of sticks or a Jenga tower or something like that, it doesn't make your game have depth. And Puerto Rico does have quite a lot of depth. And I think those lessons have kind of been forgotten. And it always delights me when I come across a game that is a bit more elegant in its design, where there is depth out of a few mechanics as possible. I really like that. So I suppose that influence lives on in those games when I come across them.
One of my favorite writers on the internet is a guy named by the name of Jimmy Marr, and he writes a site called The Digital Antiquarian. It's about the history of computer games, like PC games.
Oh, cool.
And it's really great. He started in like the late 70s, and he's in like 1997 right now. Like, he's doing it in chronological order. Really cool.
Oh,
but
wow.
It's been great. Strong recommend on my part. But he has something he says about old games. He's like, there's two kinds of games. There's games that got played before they were released and games that didn't. And you can tell, especially in those early days when it was such a cottage industry for PC gaming, that so many games would get released that just, you can tell no one actually play tested this. And I think we actually see that today in the Kickstarter era. There's not removing gatekeepers has some advantages, but one of the trade-offs is development in games just does not happen like it used to. And yeah. Puerto Rico, whatever else its faults, it looks like it has been developed to a diamond sheen.
Possibly slightly too much.
I what you were saying there, Ian, about the difference between sort of like elegant games. I hate to use the word elegant. I try and avoid it now. And
yeah, it's a bit of a sort of like all encompassing thing, isn't it?
The concept that you don't have to have complexity to get depth. Let's just go with that, right?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
That's partly why I'm here. It's partly why I'm here doing this podcast, because I think I mentioned when we talked about Agricola all that time ago, the very first episode that we did, that I have a real hatred of point salad games, which is kind of the epitome of that thing you've gone, which is like, we won't have like four resources. Let's have 59 different resources that you need to trade in for one another to eventually trade them all up to victory points. I can't stand that style of game. And it's really weird how, as I've already mentioned, that Puerto Rico kind of kickstarted those games, and yet it is so different from them. It's like people learned the wrong lessons from Puerto Rico, mechanically speaking. I absolutely endorse, I think we all would, what all three of us would, what Nate was just saying about game development. It's so obvious now that Kickstarters are badly developed or not developed at all, because you've got the money up front on a basic game design.
Yeah.
Why bother? But that rot predates Kickstarters, because, you know, I mentioned a particular dislike of games like this, like A Feast for Odin. I know you like it, Ian, but that comes under that umbrella for me. And that way predates, well, not Kickstarter, but the dominant... He's actually holding it up. It's he loves it so much, he keeps it close to his heart.
I actually haven't played my physical copy. I have played quite a lot of Feast for Odin on BGA, and I really enjoyed those plays of it. I have bought a physical copy because I might hate it in a physical version. I don't know, and I want to find out. I haven't actually got around to playing it yet, but I really want to find out whether I'll despise it as a physical version. I don't know. I might.
You're stealing my exit speech there, but unintentionally, of course. But to go back to Puerto Rico in terms of its influence of the current era, I've kind of said a lot of things I wanted to say. I've talked about how it invented essentially role selection, or the way we understand it in the modern world. I've talked about how it started spreadsheet games and multiplayer solitaire, and now we're talking about how it's gone on to kind of influence point salad games. I've talked about how it's opened the discussions of colonialism that have come to be constructive and important and very helpful in the hobby, thanks to the patience and struggles of minority gamers. But the one thing I haven't talked about, I suppose, which Nate introduced, is San Juan. And the thing that really interests me about San Juan, I haven't played a whole lot. For those who don't know, it's a card version of Puerto Rico. You know how nowadays we get a good game nowadays. You've got a roll and write version, you've got a card version, you've got a version with miniatures, you've got, you know, all that stuff. That didn't exist back then, but Andreas Seyfarth did make a card version of Puerto Rico called San Juan. And he thinks it's better. He thinks it's a better game. This is another thing I picked out of an interview. He thinks it's better because it's faster and tighter, and he's quite surprised that it hasn't actually eclipsed the original, although he acknowledges that, that Puerto Rico is a deeper, I suppose, richer game, and I guess that's what's kept it up to date. But, you know, as Nate pointed out, San Juan in itself has gone on to be an influence on a whole bunch of other things. So, you know, we couldn't really let this slip without bringing that up again. So it really has been, it's left a long trail of marks in the hobby, despite its problematic subject matter.
Does San Juan have a sort of problematic setting as well? I don't know it at all.
It doesn't have, it's the same setting, right? I mean, it's okay. It's colonial stuff, but it doesn't involve bringing colonists in or settlers or whatever you want to call them euphemistically. You just play the card and the card makes a thing.
Right.
So it's a little more white gloved in that sense.
Well, green there's a little, disc, I should say.
Yeah. Green disc. There's no like boat with like literal little brown tokens coming in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could still make a decent argument for it. And I'm freely willing to admit that might be one of my own blind spots. I'm fine owning San Juan. I have the game. I really like it. I don't own Puerto Rico anymore, and I felt a little gross getting back into it. But who knows? It's a foolish consistency. Hobgoblin of a small mind. So.
So, gents, our hour is almost up. Let's come to some conclusions and recommendations. Would you still recommend Puerto Rico to our listeners and to the modern hobby audience?
So I'm going to go out the trap with this one as the person who probably bigged it up the most as a mechanical game. Now, and this is where I was going to say you've kind of stolen my exit speech, because I wanted to talk about playing the game physically, which I never have. I really enjoy playing Puerto Rico as a spreadsheet. I really enjoy playing it online on BGA. But playing it in real life involves sitting down and spending 90 minutes to 2 hours shifting discs around. And while I like it and while I recognize, you know, I think it's a good idea that we've got a new edition, though, that at least try to sanitize the theme, even if it's not been successful, or even perhaps in some ways made things worse, as you were discussing, Ian, I just can't imagine that style of play now, physical face-to-face, is going to be compelling enough to break out frequently.
Yeah.
However much I like it, and I think it should be played perhaps online as a we've already talked about what an influential game it's been in all sorts of different ways. And I think it's worth investigating for that reason. But yeah, playing it physically, I just can't imagine doing it, especially, you know, in some ways, seeing the ship, actually physically taking the disc off the ship, it would make me feel far dirtier than playing the online or a spreadsheet version, which eliminates that entirely, would do. So I like it. I'm not quite sure I can say that I would recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, I've said I enjoyed our games from a sort of looking at the history of the hobby perspective, which is one of the reasons we're doing this cast. But the setting and the theming, they're just incredibly off-putting to me. I can't good conscience really recommend it because of that outside. I mean, if you want to study the history of the hobby, and it is a very influential game, as Matt said there, then yeah, give it a shot. It's on BGA. It's readily available. But just be aware of it has very colonial themes in there. Sorry, very colonial settings in there. And you might find yourself feeling incredibly off-put by that, like I did. There are other games out there that are definitely better to play. If you want to play a role selection game, we've mentioned Eminent Domain, we've mentioned San Juan, we mentioned Twilight Imperium. I mean, Twilight Imperium is a hard thing to recommend.
If you don't like sitting down with components for 2 hours, I don't know. I got bad news about Twilight Imperium.
How about 8 hours instead?
Apparently, I don't know if this is a joke, but I have seen a number of trailers that it's coming to BGA, Twilight Imperium.
A banner up at Spiel Essen this year saying it's coming to BGA.
If it was at Spiel Essen, it might have been AI generated.
it seems like the kind of thing that's the result of a dare.
Yeah,
like someone at BGA says you couldn't do Twilight. I'd be like, oh yeah, just watch me. I'm inclined to agree, kind of with the. I'll go with the kind of ambivalent recommendation. I always under every circumstance, I would rather play a physical game. And partially that's because of how I cognitively handle games. I play them really poorly in non-physical versions, which is my excuse for losing to Matt so badly. but it's true. Like, I don't grok patterns very well unless I'm doing something with my hands. But this particular game, it's really one that I admire more than I enjoy in terms of a design kind of thing. It's not something that I personally compelled to play more than once every few years myself. I had a copy for a long time, and to give you the kind of the idea of what kind of gamer I am, I traded it away for a copy of Nexus Ops.
Nexus Ops is great. Come on.
It's one of the best, but it's much more my kind of game. and so that kind of gives you an idea of how this game sat with me. It's aside from the problematic setting and the theme, which is an issue, and you'll know, especially if that's a really big issue for you or something you can overlook. But I do feel the game is just, because of how tight and how tightly wound it is mechanically, it's almost like this hermetically sealed kind of quality to it. It almost sometimes feels a little bit like I'm like a little like it's playing me sometimes, but I think that's more a me problem than a game problem. So yeah, I would give, yeah, if you want to check it out, it's worth your time. It's compelling. There's a lot to do strategically, but it's a little stuffy for my tastes, to be real honest. I'm much more of a San Juan person. I would rather play that 4 times out of 5.
Fantastic. Well, we're all off to an art gallery for next time, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cult of the Old.
Take care.
Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks very much for listening. Editing for the cast was done by me, Ian McAllister. The music for the cast was provided by my brother-in-law, David Dolliver, with my friend, Alistair McLeod. Our logo was created by Rachel Wines Thrower. If you like what you've listened to, then the best way to help us out is by telling your friends about us and leave us a review and rating on your podcast host of choice. You can follow the hosts on various social media platforms, and we'll put links to all of those in our show notes. You can come and chat to the team and fellow game enthusiasts in our Discord, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do so through our Patreon. Links to both of those will be in the show notes as well. If you'd like to contact us about any of the games we've covered on the cast, should cover, or anything else really, you can contact us at cultoftheolduk@gmail.com. Bye for now.